We're a little bit late on our time, so we'll go directly into the next presentation, which is on the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. Our presenter is Stephen Smolian, who is the operator of Smolian Sound Studios and who is preparing a comprehensive discography and broadcast discography of the New York Philharmonic.
The original plans are being slightly altered due to technical difficulties. Hearing is the first recording made by a symphony orchestra and issued for commercial purposes. Can we have the lights, please, and get that picture? This is Walter Damrosch conducting something which is called on the label the Damrosch Symphony Orchestra. We are going to have the label in a moment. The record was made in April, or was released in April 1904. This predates the earliest known record by a symphony orchestra up to this point, which was by Edward Cologne, issued on Pathé in 1907. So this record really puts history back 3 years and brings the honors back, I'm ashamed to say, in this multilingual area, brings the honors back to the United States for the first recording made by a symphony orchestra with a professional symphonic conductor. At least so acknowledged by the record companies on its label and in its catalogs. Mike? This is from the Columbia Record, the dealer magazine. We seem to be, take my word for it.
Don't show them the next
one. Don't show them the next one either. The next one is the article from the Columbia dealer magazine with a photograph of Walter Damrosch announcing that these records were being made and would be available for sale immediately. These records consist of this record, the one you've just heard. No other record was issued from these sessions. And to the best of my knowledge, nothing exists on these except this one record that we've just heard, which was copied and is by the Library of Congress, made available to us under the fair use provisions of the new copyright law. Apparently, there was quite a hassle down there in getting clearance for this purpose. At any rate, this is one of the fruits of the research I've been doing on the recording and broadcast history of the New York Philharmonic. Doesn't sound like a big deal, especially when you hear the record. I don't believe there are any strings present. There were other records made at this session, presumably. I don't know what they are. The Walter Damrosch papers exist in two places. They are voluminous. They're about half of them are at New York Public Library, where they have been indexed and then shifted around twice more, which makes the index worse than useless. The other half is down at the Library of Congress. I have not had a chance to inspect them yet. I'm pretty sure that the information about these sessions or this session is not in New York. That's as far as that little piece of research has gone so far. I'd be interested in knowing what else was done and what the circumstances were which A, made Columbia approach Damrosch or vice versa, and why no further records were released. Right now, that's a question mark, but at least we do have a step backward into the commercial end of recording of symphonic orchestras. Hans von Bülow did make a recording, or a recording was made of him. It was more as an experiment and certainly was not issued for commercial sale. Dealing with the New York Philharmonic, the name itself announces a conglomeration of orchestras. The New York Symphony Orchestra, which is basically the orchestra which Damrosch conducted, was coexistent with the New York Philharmonic for many years and was eventually absorbed by it. During roughly the same period, especially when the orchestra conductorship was up for grabs, a number of other orchestras flourished in New York City. I won't go into the details right now except to say that it seemed to be a rich man's plaything to get the conductor you backed to lead the major symphony orchestra. And there was a lot of infighting concerning this aspect of the status of the very wealthy, which resulted in a number of short-lived orchestras. Among them is the new symphony orchestra, which became the National Symphony Orchestra and then was absorbed by the Philharmonic. The City Symphony Orchestra, which was not absorbed by the Philharmonic, except for the board members. The board members being the people who wagged the financial end of the orchestra. And, of course, the New York City Symphony. That is the New York Symphony Orchestra, which was absorbed by the Philharmonic in 28 and was the last orchestra to be absorbed by it. There's an interesting postscript to that as well. Those people from the two-thirds of Damrosch's orchestra, which was not absorbed by the New York Philharmonic, then was given an option, which most of them accepted, of becoming the National Symphony Orchestra. If the name sounds familiar, it's because it's a reuse of an old name, but it really stood for the Orchestra of the National Broadcasting Company. And when Damrosch's orchestra was absorbed, Damrosch himself became the music director of the National Broadcasting Company and began the series of children's concerts for which this orchestra was employed. Actually, he began the year before, and those broadcasts with the New York Symphony Orchestra were broadcast, and those will be included in the book. The book is actually divided into a number of parts, that dealing with broadcasts, that dealing with phonograph records, and that dealing with the other media on which sound would have been preserved, primarily television and film. The question of what was the first orchestra to broadcast has come up. It is generally acknowledged to have been a one-shot by the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. I haven't had a chance to double-check that aspect of things, but that seems to be in the radio histories. However, the radio histories are wrong about when the Philharmonic first broadcast. They give the date of November of 1923, and it was actually the first week in August of 1923, almost the whole first week. And that was a series of outdoor Lewis and Stadium concerts. And it was also the first year that the New York Philharmonic was the official orchestra of Lewis and Stadium. Being official orchestra did not mean that the entire crew showed up at Lewis and Stadium. It was not only normal to deputize and hire extra musicians from other orchestras, of which the Philharmonic was then the core, but the conductor of those first Philharmonic Lewis and Stadium concerts, who was Willem van Hoogstraten, later ended his association with the New York Philharmonic, except for the summer concerts, and went to Portland, Oregon to become conductor of their symphony orchestra. And when he came back, he brought his concertmaster with him to be concertmaster of the summer symphony orchestra. As a matter of fact, in the newspapers, you can find the personnel of the orchestra, usually in the opening publicity barrage, that is, of the summer orchestra. There are actually three sets of programs, broadcasts, which are being covered in here. The first is the regular concerts, the concerts everybody knows, the concerts which are broadcast nationally. And incidentally, the CBS count of this is our umpteenth broadcast is of those broadcasts over the CBS network, not of the earlier material before CBS was even in the picture. The second series are the children's concerts. Those were broadcast for a while nationally, and then became more and more restricted, and eventually were only broadcast in New York City by CBS, and then through the public broadcasting station in New York, that is the wholly owned station by the city, WNYC. Sometime in the late 30s, it further becomes complicated because the broadcast times were variable. There were, if you took one feed, you went off after an hour and a half. If you took another one, you went off after the full two-hour concert. So that I've heard transcriptions of some of the children's concerts which end in different places for the same concert. Identifying the music on the children's concerts is a real hassle. First of all, it was customary to have the kids do the program notes. The state of musicology in the 1930s was never, well, was emerging. Let's be polite about it. It was also customary to do transcriptions. It was also customary to do bits and pieces from other pieces and rename them. The musicology was quite often suspect, a la the Fritz Kreisler transcriptions, which turned out to be by Fritz Kreisler. There's a concert which involves Henri Casa de Sceaux, who was similarly inclined, but more massively with full orchestras, or with a miniature orchestra. And those, alas, have to be identified in some way, which creates a cataloging problem. There are also no reviews of the children's concerts, so there's very little way, no reviews, either as of concerts or as of broadcasts, with the exception of general blah. But specific reviews don't go into details, and so a lot of the identification of pieces is still guesswork. I've spoken with a number of people trying to reduce some of the guesswork. The Ernest Schelling estate still has a lot of the parts, Schelling being the conductor during the 20s and 30s. And I've had some success in untangling some of the knots. The third area are the summer concerts, Lewiston Stadium, and during World War II for a couple of seasons, the concerts which also took place on Sundays, which were free, sponsored by U.S. Rubber, who had nothing but money at that time to get rid of and use it for good public relations purposes. There is one set of programs for the Lewiston Stadium concerts, which is missing one year, and which was never revised. There's nothing in handwriting in it. There is a problem with outdoor concerts, as you all know, which is called rain. Furthermore, five concerts or six concerts a week were given, usually with one rehearsal. There's one astounding period of time when Van Hoogstraten conducted every concert for 8 weeks. The repertoire must have been enormous. There is some duplication, of course. In the course of the year, he got lazy and so forth. But when it rained, if it rained before a certain time, the concerts were moved indoors and the program was changed. They were moved indoors to the Great Hall, which is similar to the Palestra in Philadelphia and other caverns which we all know and hate. And there are complaints in the reviews about the sound quality, even in 1924 and 25, as compared with the outdoor sound. The summer concerts were first written up
in an article in Popular Radio, which appeared, I believe, in November of 1923, covering that one week of concerts. They were sponsored by Popular Radio. They were not sponsored with announcements by Popular Radio because in those days it was considered unethical to have any announcement on the radio that pushed a product or a service. Nonetheless, they were instrumental in getting this on the air. There are a lot of complications in terms of which lines we use to feed the functions of the various other broadcast companies. I won't go into the details here, they'll be in the book. But one of the difficulties then became what concert was rained out, what concert was shifted, and so forth and so on. All the information about the programs will be indexed, so it's and are also listed chronologically with their conductors. It meant looking through the newspapers to see whether it rained the day before. Summertime, the critics are not super active, so again, there were not many reviews to go by. Lewiston Stadium also had a tradition of encores, some of which are announced in the occasional review, some of which turn up other places, and most of which I just simply have to leave out, and you will have to assume that there are encores. Also, not entire programs were broadcast. Sometimes it was one of these things like every Wednesday, the second half of the concert, and every Sunday's whole concert would be broadcast, except for when there was a political convention. So you have to find out if there was a political convention. The radio listings of that period are quite unspecific, and so you have to use a lot of imagination and use the other means within the newspapers for identifying things. I can add one other interesting facet to this, that one's normal inclination would be to go to the newspaper of record in New York, which is the New York Times. However, the newspaper of the wealthy was the New York Herald Tribune. And the Tribune listings concerning radio activities of symphony orchestras as well as all other activities of symphony orchestras are far more extensive than in the Times during that period. However, they do not show up that frequently in the music pages. They show up in the society pages. So you really have to dig around to find stuff. Now, as far as the records are concerned, Columbia recorded for a number of record companies. That is, the Philharmonic recorded for a number of record companies, among which was Columbia first. And after this 1904 recording, there was a lapse until 1917 when they pick up again with Columbia. Then they go to Victor, then to Brunswick, then back to Victor, then back to Columbia, except for a concurrent series of music appreciation records, which they did under Henry Hadley for Ginn and Company. In addition, the other orchestras, which were eventually absorbed by the Philharmonic, included records for Pathé, the new symphony orchestra recorded for them under Otto Badansky. Well, and recently the Philharmonic has made a record for London, just to make things a little bit more pleasant. We are all familiar with the tools of discography and the information which we like. Mike, can we have the first transparency, please? Different information is available from what remains from the different record companies. This is a general outline of how the listings of each broadcast event or recording event will appear, up to where it says time of performance. That covers the recording event, and it includes the work, the selection, the recording date, where recorded, the city and the studio. I won't go into why those are necessary at this point, but talking with the technical committee earlier and working off Bill's talk yesterday, it's helpful to know what microphones and what acoustic setup was used for a recording session if you're going to have to eliminate the distortion induced by those when you're going after acoustic truth. The conductor, of course. It will be assumed that it's the New York Philharmonic, unless another orchestra appears under that. instrumental soloists, those who were hired, and then those who were members of the orchestra. Remember, this is a discography of an orchestra, and the important thing is the orchestra and its members. The conductor is hired by the orchestra. The time of performance, and that is the time of performance at the proper playing speed of the record, which means each record has to be pitched, certainly in the 78 area, and the timing derived at that proper playing speed. The recording company, of course, and the producer, again, acoustic information sometimes is deducible by knowing who was producing the record and what his habits were. Now, I've divided the records themselves into two groups, which the first of which is called directly derived recordings. That is basically the old 78s, those, and of course the new direct-to-disc recordings, those where there is no medium interfering between the creation of the record and the pressing of the record, which can make acoustic or, for that matter, musical changes. Section B covers indirectly derived recordings, which is your tape recording, of course, but would also incidentally cover Pathé recordings which are made from cylinders, master cylinders. I think it's an important distinction to draw because the information concerning each will have different reliability. The matrix number on 78s is included. You can see it says electric in this case. It would say acoustic if that were the recording process used. I am including releasing and deletion dates. I think it's less important with the 78s. It's very important with the LPs and tracing their history. You want to go on to the next slide, Mark? And save that one. We'll come back to it. Here's a sample page which involves 78s. It also involves the LP issues of them. I should point out one very intriguing and difficult problem in dealing with Columbia records starting about 1941. And that is they were never recorded on 78. They were recorded on 16-inch discs in greater length than the normal 78 size and then dubbed onto 78s. When the LPs came out, the LPs were then dubbed from the 16-inch discs and not from the 78s, as a rule, and the splices were made as they were normally done in a radio station with an overlap. There was an article about that not too long ago in High Fidelity, an interview with Ted Wallerstein by, I think it was, I don't remember who it was at the moment. Ward Botsford, right. And the tape of that interview is at New York Public Library, which covers far more than was actually in the High Fidelity article. So in a sense, even the 78s are indirectly derived, but since I suppose I'm used to working with 78s and matrix numbers, and there is some information to be drawn from that, I've gone ahead and charted them out this way. You can show one of the LP ones if you like, Mike, the next one. I see a beautiful fingerprint on that. Since a record is simply a means for storing and retrieving sound, or from which sound can be conveniently retrieved, the same thing is true of tapes. I don't know of anybody who's really gone into this up to this point, but I feel very strongly that every manifestation that comes from the master tape deserves the same kind of scholarly apparatus as the one thing that we're normally used to having, which is the phonograph record. All right. I'm including here some other information which is not normally done in discographies. And you may notice also that for the LPs there are no matrix numbers. We'll come to that in a little while. I'm including side and the selection on the side for the LPs. I've sort of dodged the issue of doing that on tape. The cassettes are almost always, I have found no exceptions yet, in the same order and with the same turnover point as the LPs. The 8-track cartridges are another matter entirely. They're often reprogrammed, though the content is usually the same. The release date and the deletion date. The release date, first of all, to tell you in what sequence the same recording, indirectly derived, of course, was issued. And the deletion date to give you some idea of the rarity of that particular edition, and also to tell you if it is available at the time of publication. Remember, Columbia went through a greatest hits period on LP and caused all kinds of tremendous problems which have to be dealt with by this kind of elaborate apparatus, or else it simply can't be dealt with. That includes things like pieces which are included in albums. You have to deal with the record within the album and the position of the selection on it, and then that record as being in a package. Columbia has one other interesting habit, which is to take a number of these collective records and, without changing the record number, also stick them in a box and give that box a number. Now, those records may be issued 15 years apart. So there will also be a file at the end of this which will have each record number that is in its earliest LP issue. It's simply a convenient tool, mostly the first mono LP issue, and a reference by chart from other numbers which will refer you to that extensive listing of the contents of the record, and that way you don't end up having to list the couplings every time. And that's the way I dodge the coupling question, which is somewhat murderous when you get involved with pieces which last 2 minutes and 3 seconds and have 15 of them on a record. Now, if the record is from a 78 and is an LP dub, I've also checked the pitch of the LP dubs, and the playing speed of that dub is also indicated. Now, I found, for example, the Neiman Marcus set to be wildly off speed, the recent Neiman Marcus New York Philharmonic 5-record box, and have been putting in the proper playing speed of that record so that it plays in pitch. So in one case, it's something like 32.7 RPM, so that you can actually hear as close as they get to the record. It's important to hear it, of course, played in pitch. Now, I have not included matrix numbers for LPs, I know it's a number that's on the record. I really don't believe it tells us anything that we need to know. It's a convenient tool for the record company. Each time they go to cut the record, it gets, again, that LP matrix number with a different suffix. Each time it's cut, there's usually some small change in equalization. The information about these suffixes, which are usually letters, is in no way convenient. I don't know if even all that paperwork still exists at Columbia, which is, of course, the major company with which we're dealing here. I should also add that Columbia's files of 78 matrix numbers does not include take numbers. And what take numbers are included in the Columbia files have been written in by the archivists at Columbia from information supplied by discographers. Now, as far as the matrix number is concerned, if there's an error on the master, the letter suffix is advanced when it's recut with the corrected content. But only the suffix, not the matrix number. And sometimes it's just impossible. You do not have a file of every. Even Library of Congress will not hold a file of each letter through double Z of each time the record gets a new master plate made. If the record is re-equalized, which is usually just the suffixes change, sometimes the content is altered and just the suffix is changed. And of course, the label copy is changed most of the time. Also, if the record is carried into a foreign company's catalog by license or by other association, the matrix number is totally different. They use their own system. I also have compiled a chart of orchestral personnel first chairs, so that if you have a record or a broadcast, and if the fellow wasn't sick that day, and if it's before the orchestra went into having revolving first chairs, that is, alternate halves of a concert, suffixes change. Sometimes the content is altered and just the suffix is changed. And of course, the label copy is changed. Most of the time. Also, if the record is carried into a foreign company's catalog by license or by other association, the matrix number is totally different. They use their own system. I also have compiled a chart of orchestral personnel first chairs, so that if you have a record or a broadcast, and if the fellow wasn't sick that day, and if it's before the orchestra went into having revolving first chairs, that is, alternate halves of a concert, changing the first oboe player, for example, you can tell who is playing the prominent part in each section. There are people who are interested in this kind of thing, and it's of great help in identifying these people. Also, since this is a discography of the orchestra didn't have one even within its own files. I had to compile it for their own use. And it's turned out to be a very useful tool. There are a number of changes, then, in the usual 78 working from matrix number discographic processes when dealing with LPs, at least that I've introduced here. One, of course, is the use of timings, which I think should also be included with 78 discography. I know it's a pain in the neck, and I know you have to pitch the record properly and get that number down, but I think it's a great help. Second is the use of issue and cutout dates. Records come in of the catalog, go out of the catalog, switch companies, licensed, so forth and so on. I really think it's important that that information, which give the history of the record as a device of commerce, as well as a storage device for sound, be included. Side and band identification. I understand that Library of Congress is planning to go to something like this fairly soon. I encourage them. Am I right, David? No, I'm wrong. They will be including timings where they are on the records. That's all. Well, sign and band can save you an awful lot of time when you're looking for a selection. And it is also giving you the definite position of that unique item on that unique record number as an identifier. The use of the producer. I'm afraid we have to accept him as a necessary evil if that's your point of view. Nonetheless, he is involved not only in pop, in classical records, but to a greater extent in class, in the pop stuff and in other processed sound records. And I think it will be of great interest in the future to know who the producer was. And since that information is available, let's use it. Other than disc formats, I think that's self-evident here. It's still a pain in the neck, and getting the information is much harder than getting the information about the records. And finally, the concept of the directly derived recording as opposed to the indirectly derived recording. That is, the use of the metal matrix on which is directly derived from the recording session itself to press the records as opposed to passing through the tape processing, meddling process before you finally hear the product. And of course, that involves the whole question of editing. You might go to the next slide, Mike. To compile this information, I've gone through a number of offices, I might add, at Columbia to get label copy, to Xerox it, and put it all in numerical order for the Philharmonic project. This is the basic piece of written information which travels with the record in its processing trail through the record company. One of the difficulties is assuming that their timings are right. I've simply had to do that unless I've found the conflict, which is one of the things that the timings do turn up for you. Hallelujah Chorus from Messiah is not exactly a standard title. Everything has to be switched around by you to identify the piece properly so that when you file them, there will be some logic to the filing. And I have two notebooks like this of label copy for Columbia, for the records, for the tapes, for the quad records, many of which are not identified on the record except by a Q prefix to the matrix number. So again, there I've included the information, I've carried it forward. That's the only instance, incidentally, I've found where the matrix number has been useful to me in working with the LPs. There's many other documents which are generated by the recording process, none of which can be accepted to be accurate. Everything has to be checked. I won't go into the reasons for it. You can figure out very quickly that a secretary typing this, who does not know anything about classical music, is going to make some very interesting boners, and they do occur. Columbia later revised its label. This is a sort of a mid-period Columbia label copy for LPs. There are two earlier stages of it. And the current one, which is the next slide, Mike. Which covers a number of the different formats, that is tape as well as disc, provided they were all issued the same time. If the issue date for a cassette or an 8-track cartridge was later, it got its own label copy because it was processed in a different chain. This is one of those cases when half of the record is New York Philharmonic and the other half isn't, and has to be so cataloged. I know this isn't the most thrilling subject in the world, folks, but dealing with it is really requires a lot of concentration, and you find that you're working with people at the record companies who have never thought ready to go to the publisher sometime around the first of the year. I think it's probably unlikely knowing the way things happen, but I'm aiming for it. I assume that it will be ready sometime. It's being published by Greenwood Press, and given lead time, sometime about 1980, in the course of 1982, it should appear. It will be quite thick and quite large, and I hope will make some degree of sense. I'm interested in your comments.
Ray Weil, I just wanted to give you one other bit of work to do. It's always good to give somebody else work. Did you check the New York Evening Post for your earlier listings?
What years would that have been for?
The New York Evening Post, during the, from about 1900 to about 1929, was the paper for musical criticism. The Post, coming out in the evening, had Henry T. Finck in the beginning as its critic, and the Post was particularly good because it, Finck had a chance to go to the concert, think about it, and at his leisure get his review in the following morning, and it really did a job.
This begins
we
to
tend
sound
to
like
think it. Of the Post as it later became.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay. That's a good clue.
There is also an index, a handwritten index to it, in the possession of New York Public Library.
Ah, thank you.
Which has the original files. Yes.
I should add that I've been doing a lot of my research at the State University of New York in Albany, which has the Times and the Tribune on microfilm, and an open room into which you can just walk, open a drawer, take out what you want, put it on the machine. If you want to run a copy of it, you just go in the other room and put your money in the machine. You don't have to go through customs.
Dave Jason, I'd like to know where in your myriad and marvelous detail you list how many members of the orchestra on that particular session, or the tune, or whatever.
In Columbia's files, there is no information concerning this, nor in the Philharmonic's files. In the Victor files, there are. And when they are listed in the standard format for orchestrations.
How about checking with the AF of M? These men had to be paid.
I realize
and how much are they going to, you know, they're not going to just pay for 30 people if there are 60. That kind of thing. And what instrumentation was used?
Well, the instrumentation is standard scoring, of course. It's just a question, basically, of whether the winds or brasses have been doubled and how many strings are in use. Unless there's a transcription, in which case I'd note that. I don't know how far back AF of M keeps those records available, for one thing. For a second thing, I have access to the Philharmonic's records, and they seem to be in such a generally loose form that, frankly, my grant, which is an NEH grant, and even my own contribution simply couldn't cover the amount of time it would take to reconstruct that. And frankly, on LP, since it seems to be standard size, unless it's a Vivaldi concerto performed by 114 strings, which you can tell pretty darn fast, I'm not so sure how pertinent that is. I do not have another 2 years to put into that, certainly.
It would seem to me, basic for discographical needs of any subject, that you know who the hell is playing whatever it is you're recording, and you know it would be nice to know what Walter Damrosch used and how many pieces in his 1904 band compared to what Bernstein used and compared to what you know is going on during the years, because they do change.
The acoustic process, those records certainly do not exist at Columbia. We're lucky to have what we have. The union was not even formed in 1904, and the main difference is that the requirements of the acoustic recording process meant that there were changes in orchestration to accommodate the recording horn, and where I've been able to figure them out, I've indicated them from listening when I don't have any hard information to go by. But the idea of reconstructing that at this point, I think, is for what the reward would be, just totally financially impossible. We have to live with things as they are. I would like to be able to get other information, for example, from CBS about the suffix numbers and what was done on each suffix in terms of equalization and so forth. That would require going through the engineering department and looking for pieces of paper that probably no longer exist. I had proposed interviewing the recording producers and also doing a chapter on the finances of recording along with this book. I have all that information in its raw state and was simply unable to get funding for it. So again, we have to live with the practical. I think you'll find, however, that there's a lot of information in here that has not been available before, and it will include as well, due to the timings, the first timing book, as far as I know, which will give timings for records rather than for concert performances, which will be an aid to radio stations and the like, for the standard repertory and for a lot of the non-standard and, if you'll pardon my saying so, substandard repertory. This would mean that there's not tuning up times, coughing, people being seated during between first and second movements and so forth, which are in built into those other timings, which is the fallacy in using those books for radio programming. Mr. Stroud.
John Stroud speaking. To what extent do you think it's worthwhile, and is it possible even, to indicate what the most primitive source of the recording, particular recording, still surviving is?
I have tried finding what is in the 16-inch disc file at CBS Records. They are very, very reticent. I've discussed with I presume this is what you're speaking to, basically. I have discussed with a number of the producers there over the years the idea of going back to the 16-inch discs instead of to the tapes that were prepared from them in 1949 for remastering. And it is actually, somebody finally said, oh, that's an interesting idea, instead of, oh my God, that's financially impossible. I don't know whether that's progress or not. only the future will tell. However, I do know of one instance where that did take place, which was on the Columbia Record Club issue of the Schumann Third Symphony, for which they actually went back to the 16-inch discs. That was Doug Duer, the late Doug Duer's doing. And the new Odyssey issue of that same performance, I believe, derives from that tape rather than from the one for the early ML from 1948 or 9. Mike
Beal, am I not right that Columbia occasionally actually cut 78 masters at the same time that they were also cutting their 16-inch lacquers?
I don't know. And one of the reasons I don't know is that I have made an extensive search of the Columbia files of photographs looking for this process in use. I have never found one. There was also a period of time when they ran tape and 16-inch discs concurrently. I don't know which one they eventually used for mastering or when they switched over. Nobody seems to remember, and there is no memo concerning it. It was just a verbal order. By the same token, in going through a set of books I found over in the recording building, there are the diaries for booking the studios, which don't give indication of what was done on that day, but just who the performer was, in which I encountered something called Studio X.
W-O-R, maybe.
No, it turned out to be Liederkranz Hall. But the only way I know that is that I ran into somebody there after asking a lot of questions and being that pesky little kid again, of finding out somebody who remembered what it was. And so that's my only authority for that, and that should really be in quotes. I have no written piece of paper to that effect.
Yeah, you also mentioned that sometimes the 16-inchers were recorded at longer lengths than the eventual sides. Is that really the case? Maybe they would play for 6 or 7 minutes and that would be cut to two sides?
They would play for the length normally of two sides, whatever that two sides was to be. And when the LPs came out, the joins therefore happened half as frequently as with the 78s. But they did fade or find a place. The scores were marked pretty carefully by the conductors or the recording producer as to where the break would take place. I don't know that they ever ran an extra two chords at the end to come out of some kind of a harmonic difficulty so that they could splice it on and make the side break. I tend to doubt it.
One other thing that Peter Goldmark, in one article, or maybe it was in his book, mentioned that the first transfers which he made for LPs were not done via tape, that they made the side joins by playing 78s. I did not have a chance to cross-examine him on that and many other points that I feel his stories are a little flaky.
Yes, well, Peter Goldmark is has to be taken with a grain of salt. I won't go into the reasons at this moment. That's a diatribe for another day. But what was done was that the 16-inch discs were played directly into the cutter through an equalization system without passing through the tape editing process initially.
In other words, the first LPs may have been taken off of the discs, but it wasn't the 78s they were taking them off. It was the 16-inch 33s.
That is my understanding. David, is David still here? Yes.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding also?
I believe some of them were using cross-fading techniques.
Yeah, using the old radio station double turntable.
Because what he said specifically were, I think that they were using those micrometer arms that you see when you see photographs of CBS radio studios, their sound trucks for sound effects. Micrometer arms that you can dial up a particular groove and then flip a switch, it would drop down into that particular groove and it would be a repeatable device that you take the record off, put it back on, dial up a number you've prearranged, and it would come down in the same groove that it had done last time. I think that that is the way that, that they had done it. But what this would mean is, since they recorded two side lengths on the 16s, he would only have half as many side joins to
That's
do.
That's what I said.
Yeah, he never mentioned that in his article.
Well, there are a number of things in those articles which are open to question and refutation, but...
They say you take Peter Goldmark with a grain of pepper.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And in speaking with another Hungarian about Peter Goldmark, with whom he worked, Mirko Panyeko, who claims to have actually developed the LP record, which Peter Goldmark then appropriated, and I have in my possession Mirko's collection and his notebooks. And though the notebooks don't cover the engineering aspect of things, they nonetheless go back in far enough into antiquity to give that some credence. Bill.
I was curious as to whether you'd uncovered any great amount of documentation on those recordings that were made for Ginn & Company that you mentioned under Henry Hadley.
Yes, indeed. They're a special problem and discographically fascinating and musically boring. But if I can get into it to a certain extent, this was a series of records which were made by Ginn & Company to coordinate with a kindergarten through graduation from high school music appreciation process and a number of well-known educators of that period were involved in it, including people who were not only educators but suddenly became, when they had the opportunity, composers and recorded composers. Pardon? This period is actually about 1923 through their re-recording of the Ginn & Company material for Columbia, of which there is not one iota of record in Columbia's vault.
I'd noticed
the only proof I have found of it is at Ginn & Company in their publicity for their remake of the records where they say they recorded them at Columbia. They were done, of course, first acoustically and then electrically, except that they did not redo the vocal sides electrically, so those sides are acoustic in the electrical sets.
They
also changed the contents of not the first three volumes, but the last two volumes they compressed into one when they redid them electrically.
Were you aware that some of the acoustic sides were made for Jeanette originally?
Yes. I have the Jeanette. George Black was kind enough to loan me the Jeanette Matrix books, which I Xeroxed and through which I have been working. They are, what happened was the original series was done at Jeanette Studios in Newark or somewhere like that. There are photographs in the books, the teacher's manuals to accompany these sets of the acoustic recording process and then of the electrical recording room for the second set. Mm-hmm. There were actually two teacher's manuals to it. I didn't want to get into all this stuff here, but there's been a lot of homework that's had to go into it, including a delightful visit to Ginn & Company, where I found out that the name is Ginn and not Gin because Mr. Ginn was a teetotaler. Yeah.
Three short items. First of all, late addition to the program, at 1 o'clock this afternoon in the auditorium here, will be a film on